delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Welcome to this hour of We the People right here at WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and welcome into the new year. This is my first time back broadcasting with you in 2025. Thank you, listeners, for supporting this entirely funded, listener-supported Jazz and Justice station that's from the Pacifica Radio Foundation emanating out of Washington, D.C. To start out the year, we'll take a look at disability justice while offering a critique of the disabilities rights movement from within. Our guest issues a call to all of us, a call for collective liberation that is pro-Black and centers disabled people of color. Our guest is Dara Baldwin. She's an activist, scholar, writer with more than 20 years of experience in policy and social justice work. She currently runs her own equity consulting firm, D. Madrina LLC. She's held senior level positions in the federal policy arena at multiple organizations. Ms. Baldwin was the director of national policy for the Center for Disability Rights and the senior policy analyst at the National Disabilities Rights Network. She has led multiple national and international advocacy campaigns as an expert in disability laws and policy, working on housing and transportation equity, criminal justice, and many other issue areas. Her debut book is the basis of our conversation, To Be a Problem, A Black Woman's Survival in the Racist Disability Rights Movement. So without further ado, good morning, Ms. Baldwin. Thank you for being with us.
Peace and blessings, everyone. Thank you, David, for having me. And Happy New Year to everyone out there. Wishing all the best in 2025.
So let's get right into it. How are we to understand the notion of disability and particularly respecting and appreciating all people?
Great question. And thank you again for having me. As I discuss in the book, we have moved to a space of using disability justice. And it is a new movement, not so new, it's over a decade years old, but they have 10 principles. And one, the first is intersectionality. And the last is collective liberation. You can find them, just Google disability justice and find all 10. But I say that to say, in answer to your question, is intersectionality. When you do and work in a space of social justice and intersectionality, you include all people, all things that are happening in people's lives. A word that I have coined is multi-marginalizations. And we live multi-marginalized lives. And that came from the fact that in the disability rights community, they don't see that. They look at your disability is the only thing that is important for you to fight for. And when young Black and Brown activists, Indigenous activists started getting involved, pushed back and said, no, I'm also a person who is queer, a person who's formerly incarcerated, an immigrant. All of those things are my marginalizations, and I have to fight for all of them. And so that's where disability justice really started, in the root of removing itself from a white-centered, white supremacist disability rights theory and practice to becoming a more inclusive, right, movement of disability justice.
So I just want a strategic reiteration here. The mainstream would somehow universalize an abstract notion of disability, but you mentioned in particular, and I hope people didn't miss it, the concept of disability justice in particular. Am I getting that right?
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. Disability rights movement, just like anything in the United States, was created by white folks, and it is a system that is created on systemic racism. And disability justice is a different movement. And this has happened across multiple social justice places. One area is reproductive rights, right? Black women and Black, in particular, Black women, Black people who identify as women got tired of the reproductive rights community not listening to them. And so reproductive justice was created about 30 years ago now. And the movement that is completely different and completely not on the same category as reproductive rights, who reproductive rights was only looking at Roe versus Wade, and reproductive justice was saying, no, we have to encompass all of the multi-marginalizations in our lives. They were also the ones who said, we need to codify Roe versus Wade as a law, and were ignored, right, by reproductive rights community. Another area is housing, right? Housing rights and housing community, and again, the fight was created by white folks on a white supremacist. And now you have housing justice, which was created by Black and Brown folks and has a different meaning and different work and different movement than housing rights.
So there's a lot that you offered us just now, for which I'm very, very grateful. Let's see if we can make our way step by step. So you're beginning to give us an understanding of disability justice. And you're speaking with a lot of power and strong voice here. So I imagine, being that we're broadcasting from Washington, D.C., kind of the seat of all these large coalitions that work on policy and social justice issues, if you have the same strong voice that you're beginning with now, and I assume that will persist throughout our conversation, I'm sure folks notice this energy and this dedication and kind of ask, who are you? On what basis are you saying these outrageous things? How dare you challenge us? Can you give a little response to that?
Yes, and I laugh because everyone, David and I are old friends, so he knows this. And
yeah,
you are
from the
correct.
Criminal justice advocacy community.
Yes, yes. And you are correct. Why the title of my book is To Be a Problem, A Black Woman's Survival in the Racist Disability Rights Movement. And I know most people really gloss over introductions to book, but please do not gloss over my introduction. It explains exactly what David's talking about, but I also have a glossary of definition of words that are defined throughout the book. And so it's a foundation for you to read it. But to answer your question, to be a problem comes from W.E. Du Bois, Souls of Black Folks, when he was in the South talking about racism and doing exactly what you just said, David, being a strong voice and telling a group of people that what you are doing is wrong and you need to change how you're doing this. Is where I come from. And you are correct. I have been in Washington, D.C. for now over 21 years. I can't believe I'm saying that. Doing this work, sitting at tables like the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, the Justice Roundtable, where David and I met, and doing work there and working in large coalitions. I also discussed that in my book, To Be a Problem, about how D.C. works and how it functions. And yes, I got pushback, especially in the disability rights community. As I discussed in the book, CCD is the large overarching civil rights, they consider themselves, coalition, like the Leadership Conference, and many groups here, like I said, housing justice, transportation, have large coalitions, Transportation Equity Caucus. But CCD was the one for disability communities. There's 122 organizations there. I was the only person of color, not just Black, no Latinas, no South Asians, who was doing public policy. And I was sitting in the
room. Can I stop you just for a moment? You mentioned an acronym, and I want to make sure people are following you. CCD, that's the Consortium for Constituents with Disabilities.
That's correct. Consortium for Citizens, for Constituents with Disabilities. When I was there, it was Citizens. And they changed their work, their name to Constituents because of their work around the public trust. Let me be clear, right? It wasn't because they were trying to be civil, right? They want that money. Those organizations do a lot around public trust. And so CCD, right? Which is, again, we're talking acronyms in DC. So thank you for stopping me. Sitting at those tables and telling them, okay, yes, you're discussing education, but you're not discussing issues that are issues and problems to Black and Brown families who have students with disabilities, who are students with disabilities. And I got pushback. And you're a problem. Like every Thursday, they would call my boss and say she needs to be fired. You need to get rid of her. Does she have to bring up race every time she comes in a room? And it's like, she's a Black woman. And so I journal. I journal every day and in my life, and I'm a writer. And I wrote that title down a long time ago. I reread W.E. Du Bois, like I reread, you know, Bell Hooks and everyone else, you know, and I had reread Souls of Black Folks, and I put it to the side and said, when I write this book, I want it to be the title. And so that's where it comes from. So yes, I got constant pushback. I get constant pushback in most every room I'm in, because on the other side, the civil rights community wasn't talking about disabilities. Now I'm glad it's been a good 15 years of us pushing. They would put out letters of support for something, or letters of opposition, or any letters, and mention every group, right? The LGBTQ and the immigration community, but never disabilities. And I would always have to send in language and say, could you include the disabilities community? And so, yes, I've always been known as someone who speaks the truth strongly and with receipts, right? Let's not sit here and talk about things that I don't have backup and tell you what's going on. So yes, I've always been, quote unquote, the problem in the room, and I'm happy and I'm blessed that I've been able to do that.
So if you put the energy in this conversation in two ways, lived experience, both yours and those of people who live with disabilities, who even thrive with disabilities, and you've made allusions to policy and law affecting our lives. So I'm guessing you would affirm that policy, legislation, law does matter. And people understand, as we talk further, how you made your way into this world and what your accountability is, but what your agency is also. So that being said, let's kind of make our way and do a quick history lesson, if you will, and then I'll take a moment to reintroduce that we're speaking to Dara Baldwin. She's an activist, scholar, writer, who has done work in disability justice advocacy, which is the topic of our conversation. So first, history and law. When people think of dealing with people who have disabilities, we basically, at least in the contemporary moment, think of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. And it's a federal law that prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities in many areas of public life, employment, state and local government, public accommodations, transportation, and telecommunications. I just wanted to cover the major areas. But the struggle to secure equity and justice even happens long before that. Can you explain that, please?
Yeah, sure. So you are correct. The Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, July 26, 1990, it was signed, so about 34 years ago now, going into 35, was created because people with disabilities are not in the United States Constitution. They're not protected there. And they also were not protected in the Civil Rights Act. That is not a category that was included. Just like pregnancy wasn't included and elderly wasn't included. And so we had to add those. And people think we just came up with the ADA, like, oh, it just started. It's just like in everything else in the civil rights and the voting rights, there were steps before that. And I, again, discussed that in my book, To Be a Problem, A Black Woman's Survival and Disability Rights Movement. I lay that out so that you know that Architectural Barrier Act was first in the 1960s, and that did the doors and ramps. And also the ADA is not about doors and ramps. The ADA is a civil and human right. It is about that. It is not until 1990 that people with disabilities got the right to vote. So you understand and know that, right? Like that was only 34 years ago. That's not a long time. And it was created—
That begs a question right away. I've got to respond to that.
Yeah, sure.
Give the actuality or sort of description about not having the right to vote for this particular group of people.
Sure, and that's what I get to, right?
People don't really, it sounds so incredulous initially.
I know, and people sit in awe, and especially people who do voting rights and people who do civil rights with their mouths open and say, what do you mean? And the reason the ADA was created was because of this, is because people with disabilities weren't considered and still really aren't considered humans. In the Human Rights Commission, in the Human Rights United Nations laws, and they were not in that first trust and conversation of the human rights campaign. That did not happen, Commission, until later, until 1992, right? Like they were not in there. And the reason is, many reasons, but I'll just give some. Eugenics, of course, is part of that, right? That is part of our history. You should read about eugenics if you don't know. It's not just in Germany. I love people who think eugenics was only during the World War II. No, eugenics has been around since the beginning of time.
And in fact, since you mentioned that, it had its earliest start in the United States.
In the United States, correct. Planned Parenthood, let's be real, right? The founder of Planned Parenthood was a eugenics, right? She completely believed in dismantling and the fact that people should not exist in this world. But anyway, also in this country, 1896, you had what's called the Ugly Laws. Many people have never heard of this. And when I started doing my research and studying, and that's what I do. I'm also a scholar. I am now an adjunct professor at Georgetown McCourt School of Public Policy, teaching disability justice, along with some other things. And also teaching formerly incarcerated folks through the PIVOT program at Georgetown. But what people don't understand is in 1896 Ugly Laws, which really started in San Francisco, California, it
30
said,
years earlier, I just want to say it's well instituted. So in 1865 in San Francisco, again, there was something called the Ugly Laws.
Yes, 1865, right, the Ugly Laws. Remember, that's also, right, the end of the Civil War, right? Things were happening in 1865. But it literally said those people with disabilities are not allowed to be in public spaces. Let that sit with you. They are not allowed to come out and go to any faith-based, go to church, synagogue. They are not allowed to be out and go shopping. They are not allowed to go to school. And so at that point, people who had children with disabilities or people, they had to stay inside. And those laws have gone around the world and actually still exist, specifically in Eastern European countries. And when the war in Ukraine happened, we told everyone, go west, do not go east, because Belarus and Russia and those countries still have Ugly Laws. What does that mean? If you're caught on the streets, you're put into an institution. So then for us in this country, we had what's called the New Deal by the racist and ableist FDR. Many people don't want to discuss how racist the New Deal
was. Wait a minute. He used a wheelchair. He was suffering disabilities himself.
So FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, our president at the time who created the New Deal. Yes, as you know, in our movement, we have all skin folk and kin folk, So, right, just because you have a disability doesn't mean you believe in that. He did not. He also was not born with his disability, right? He has what we call an onset of a disability. He lived his life and then he got sick and then he wound up in a wheelchair. As I tell people, I am a person, I don't have a disability, but I possibly could. If I live long enough, I may. We actually still have that today. In 2025, we have a governor, Governor Abbott, the governor of Texas, who is in a wheelchair, didn't want people to know. But once the hurricanes came, he had in his agreement with the news people, don't show my wheelchair. And you will see him on Meet the Press earlier in his career. They go to the back table and they don't talk to him and show his wheelchair. But once the hurricanes came, those cameramen were like, forget you. We got to show this wheelchair. He does not believe in the ADA and any of those things. So just because you have a disability doesn't mean that, right? That you believe in the human and civil rights of disabled folks. And in the New Deal, what they did was they codified and said, okay, instead of keeping those people at home, let's put them in institutions. And so began the start of institutionalizing disabled folks, which started in the early 1930s of the 20th century. And unfortunately continues until this day. People don't believe that, but it actually still continues. We still have states such as Florida. Florida is the worst, who will institutionalize children from the age of 4. We have a civil rights case, again, I discuss in my book, To Be a Problem, that is going on right now, that black families in Florida whose children have been taken from them and put into an institution, and they want their children home with them. They have won the case, and unfortunately, Florida has appealed now for a second time, and those children remain in the institution and not home, not getting their education, even though we have the IDEA, the Individuals with Disability Education Act, which says that you are to educate children with disabilities. These things still go on. And its roots are founded in the ugly laws and the New Deal. I know Color of Money, people have talked about the redlining and the racism of the New Deal, but people don't talk about the ableism of the New Deal. And I do that in my books, To Be a Problem.
So sadly, you've done some overwhelming presentation here that even people who are in the majority and allegedly in a superior position or in proximities to those who have that privilege, they can convey, they can be agents of discrimination and oppression. And to get us further along in the history realm and quickly out and more into what we want to talk about as a whole with this conversation, there were surprising things that I found out, not only through research, but in dialogue with you. I'll just try to mention some major touch points. I think the one that comes to mind is, we talked about that folks understand legislative or policy response to disabilities through the ADA, but the other thing that's going on is these things didn't come out of a vacuum, like you said, and they represented decades of hard work. And something that you mentioned throughout your book is that when it comes to the younger members of our society, children, for some strange reason, the powers that be don't recognize that they're affected by managing disabilities. And so you get a whole bunch of legislation, particularly in the 70s, and I'll just be quick with this. You're the guest, I'm the host. The Individuals with Disability Education Act, Achieving a Better Life Experience Act, respectively known as the IDEA and the ABLE Acts. All these things seem to indicate that folks with disabilities, particularly, again, younger people, are just clearly not recognized by those who helped them or are supposed to help them. And so we run into problems, and then we'll get back into the whole thing of your concern about how coalitions operate. But why is it that in your thinking, in your observations, that young people are not recognized for the disabilities that they manage with?
I think I touched on it a little bit about the ugly laws and why it was considered to be harmful or horrible to have a disability. It is still considered that, and especially in Black and Brown communities, and that's a cultural thing, and we've been working on it for years. I've seen it and heard it, I still see it and hear it and get the calls and conversations. When a parent is told their child has a developmental disability, which you can usually, thank God, goodness for early intervention, we can usually tell before the age of 2 or 3, not always, right? Because again, of the public health system, which again, the public health system is racist and ableist, let's be real, right? It is a system created by white men, created on white supremacy. But if you're able to find out your child has a disability, it's, I always hear this, oh my God, I'm so sorry for that child. And we want people to know that, no, right? Like, this is a part of life, that disabled people have been around since the beginning of time, like all other people. They are no different. I say they because I'm not a disabled person. And that is why many people, move away from understanding and being proud of being disabled. And now back to disability rights community, again, for Black and Brown youth and young people, they don't find anything of value or greatness because they don't know. When you read the history or see the history of disability rights, you see movies like Crip Camp is on Netflix. If you watched that, it's a Academy Award nominated documentary. Almost every documentary in the disability rights community is about white folks, and as if white folks did it all by themselves, which is wrong. The 504 fight, which just celebrated, an anniversary, and everyone talks about the white folks who did it and don't talk about the Black people who, right, are in the pictures and you can see them. And I went and asked and said, who is this and who's this and who, right? You got Brad Lomax, who was a Black Panther, who everyone, we Black folks, I learned through learning the Black Panther history, but not disability rights. They don't talk about the Black legislators who helped with the ADA, like Barbara Jordan, who also was a person with a disability herself, a Democrat representative from Texas. I had to explain who Barbara Jordan was to these people because they didn't understand it. And again, that is a story in my book to be a problem. They didn't think she was relevant as a person, let alone as a heroine or a champion for the ADA, along with Shirley Chisholm. Even though Shirley Chisholm wasn't in Congress when the ADA passed, remember, it took years before. Like I said, this didn't happen in 1990. John Lewis, right? They're not, right? Danny Davis from Chicago, Illinois, who Danny Davis is also a Black Panther, but also is the person who wrote the language for universal services, right? For, not having any pre-existing. That shouldn't be a part of you, whether or not you get insurance. That's in the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. That came from Danny Davis and from his work. And yet they don't honor these people. So when young Black and Brown disabled folks come into the movement and they don't see themselves and they don't see themselves being honored, and they don't see the people that who look like them, we have some great indigenous, right, disabled folks who have done great work too. They aren't talked about. Those communities don't feel as if they're part of this disability rights movement, and they let people know that, and they were ignored, still are ignored. And so that's how you got disability justice. And that's why a lot of young Black and Brown folks are just starting to say and be proud. I'm Black and I'm proud. They're saying I'm Black and disabled and I'm proud.
We're talking with Dara Baldwin. Ms. Baldwin is a activist, scholar, and writer with more than 20 years of experience in policy and social justice work, particularly dedicated to our topic at hand, disability justice. You're with We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Most importantly, you're listening at our Jazz and Justice radio station, 89.3 FM, WPFW. Also WPFWFM.org. And my thanks to you who have joined us and to long-term listeners, particularly those who find the means to financially support this station. We're entirely listener-supported, bringing you Jazz and Justice one broadcast at a time, hopefully building better communities. That's our goal. And as a service to you, we will take a momentary break and have some public service announcements, but stick with us as we further our conversation about disability justice. We'll be right back after this. Thank you.
What do Angela Davis, Mehdi Hasan, Ibrahim X. Kendi, V, formerly Eve Ensler, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, Sonia Sanchez, Amy Goodman, Medea Benjamin, Mosab Abu Toha, Congresswoman Cori Bush, Noura Erekat, Congressman Jamal Bowman, Farafina Khan, Linda Sarsour, Isra Shakir, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and WPFW have in common? Well, Busboys and Poets 2025 Peace Ball, Voices of Justice and Liberation, an event featuring live music, speeches, performances, food, and drink. Details, including a complete list of speakers and performers, as well as how you can both support WPFW and join the fun on Saturday, January 18th, 8 p.m. at Arena Stage's Mead Center for American Theater, can be found at WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world. One broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, again, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM. Our guest this morning is Dara Baldwin. She's an advocate, an activist, scholar, and writer with more than 20 years' experience in policy and social justice work. She's dedicated to herself particularly to the issues regarding disability justice. Again, Ms. Baldwin, thank you for being with us this morning. We've talked about a whole bunch of things. We've talked about the history is how equity is evolving for all of us, but particularly inclusive of people with disabilities. So I'd like to further this conversation a little bit. You've mentioned some important people. I want to move us into some more actualities, but I'd like to remind people that there's a rich history for many, many people of color. Harriet Tubman and Fannie Lou Hamer did powerful, powerful work for us all and coped with and managed with disabilities all the same. Here in DC, Donald Galloway, was active in the National Federation of the Blind, but also in the NAACP, fought against jury dismissals because of the false rationale of striking people with disabilities. You mentioned Brad Lomax of the Black Panthers People's Party, who had multiple sclerosis. And he made an important contribution that started in the Bay Area, but spread particularly nationwide. Section 504 of the Rehab Act is an important victory for people with disabilities. We'll talk about that in a moment. I just wanted to mention also that there are many, many different people, more than people could possibly imagine. Eunice Diaz, the Mexican-American advocate, Alice Wong, part of the Asian-American community, along with Mia Mingus. But for instance, if we look at the Latin community, over 6 million people, 10% of Latinidad, are affected by including and making equity for people with disabilities. So the list would go on and on, and I encourage people to, you know, take some initiative with that. What is creating the problem? You know, people use the term progressive loosely, and you've talked about the various coalitions, but what are some of the telltale signs of things not working properly, the change and transformation of systems and context needs to be better?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for the brief history on that, on the Black and Brown folks who have been involved in disability equity and working and moving people into a space of understanding disability as a civil human right and a social justice movement. I will just say and add to what you said, if you have access to PBS, watch The Renegades. A documentary series done by Dayal Muhammad is one of the creators of that, as well as many other disabled people of color, Black and Brown film producers. One of the few that has just come out. And like I said, it's always been white folks, but we are working diligently to have Black and Brown voices and stories told. So I'd say that. And Don Galloway is one of those. If you see the pictures of 504, you know, everyone talks about Judy Heumann, who also was a problem in the community, but no one wants to talk about her problems and how, you know, she handled herself in this community. But you will see a picture of a man, Black man, around her all the time. Either he has his cane or his dog, his service animal. That's Don Galloway. But you have never heard Judy Heumann discuss Don Galloway. Nobody, they know, that's one of those pictures. I said, who is this gentleman? And it was Don Galloway, and he was from Washington, D.C. And I was like, wait a minute, what's that? Who? I had to, you know, learn about him. He also did a lot with Bernard Rustin and the March on Washington. He was a gay Black man himself, right? So therefore, you know, those things were there as well. A lot of those people, they don't talk about it. The founder of ADAPT, you've probably heard, on the ground activist, ADAPT group, who took over Mitch McConnell's office in June of 2017 to save the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. Their founder, Wade, went over to Selma to learn from civil rights activists what to do. And they told him, they showed him, chain yourself, throw yourself under the bus, do these things. This is how you do peaceful marching. He learned that from those civil rights activists in Alabama and went back over to Colorado, Denver, and created the ADAPT. But that's not discussed. They don't talk about that. So I'll just say that, right? And that, you know, I'll leave that out. And my foreword for my book, Keith Jones, is a very well-known activist, Black activist, younger than the people we're talking about. And please read the foreword, because he talks about this and how the erasure of Black and Brown disabled activists has caused these problems that we have. And so, you know, to talk about what's going on, as I said, it goes back and it goes also in the social justice movement, not including disabilities as a issue of human civil rights. And when you talk about progressives, you ask me, right, people, I am not a progressive. I do not consider myself a progressive. I consider myself a Black liberationist and an abolitionist. And I do discuss this in the book, to be a problem, because I keep asking progressive, what does it mean to be progressive? Because if you haven't noticed in this election we just had in 2024, people act as if the progressive movement and people on the quote unquote left are different than the conservative white folks on the right and conservative people on the right, when there is just as much racism in the progressive movement. It's just covert. It's very covertly done. It's very covertly discussed. But I will say, and I continue to say, and again, you, as you said, David, and we said earlier, in these meetings, sitting around these tables of so-called coalition building in DC, whenever we talked about the fact that public safety is not based on having more police, Black folks are saying no. White folks are saying, you don't know what you're talking about, because we don't live the same lives. And so therefore there was this constant tug and pull about why Black Lives Matter was a campaign, why Black Lives Matter was a movement of justice. And we can't use that term, and you can't do that. And we need police in order to have safety. And that whole conversation, right, from a progressive view, what progressives want to do is move the chess pieces on the board. But let it not be, you know, lost that they definitely don't want to lose control. And that is the same concept and the same fear that the quote unquote MAGA folks have, right? But that's the same conversation, that it is known that at some point the majority in this country will no longer be white people. And both progressives and conservatives need to understand this and come to some kind of understanding of where the power structure in this country lies. And so that's why when people say to me, oh, the progressive movement, I have to question, because every situation, every social justice issue area I sit in, and progressives are in charge, we have nothing but problems. And again, I talk about in my glossary, the New World Order is one that people are afraid of, that these things are going to change. And that just what we saw, we went from years of saying Black Lives Matter from 2014 and then to 2020 when George Floyd's horrific killing and Breonna Taylor's horrific killing created and said, this is why we need Black Lives Matter. This is why this has to be. This is why police does not equal public safety to Black and brown communities, specifically Black communities. And so the progressive movement is a problem. And they need to sit down and have these conversations. And, you know, the Democrats, the Republicans, these parties don't care about any of us, the Black and brown folks. And I think the Democratic Party is now sitting and having that conversation. And it's just hearing them say, we need to move away from these issue areas and these conversations lets us know that the progressive movement is just as much in turmoil as the so-called, you know, as a MAGA movement about race, about where they stand in protecting Black and brown people or engaging and being collective and collaborative with Black and brown people about our issues that are not only affecting us, but killing us every day. And so that's why in the disability movement, disability justice is moving forward and saying, we're not gonna be doing the work you do, disability rights.
So you pointed to many things in this portion of the hour. Let's begin to take the steps. What's necessary? What can you line out the actualities of making the transformations that you believe need to happen?
Yeah, sure. Like I said, I do believe in solutions and I do have hope. I honestly do, even though we're, you know, I'm living in DC, DC statehood. I have to say that DC statehood. And specifically right now, we are creating a resistance for the fascist who's about to come in office on January 20th as DC residents. He's already talking about putting a czar in control of our MPD. Although, you know, we don't want the police, but hey, what are you doing? You have no control here. So I say that to say the solutions, and I discuss in my book To Be a Problem, in the conclusion area, one is truth and reparations. Like, we cannot move forward as a community, as a society, unless we have these honest conversations, as I just talked about. There's no difference between being a progressive and being MAGA around race. And honestly say, okay, yes, we have issues and we need to resolve those. And reparations is giving us back what is right, or giving us the things, the money, right? The funding that goes to these white organizations who claim to be doing racial equity work, but have no Black and brown folks on their board or on their staff, cannot go on anymore. You cannot control this work. So that's the other side, is funders need to understand and know where the funding is going and who you're funding and what you're funding. And the third part of this is that it has to be run by those closest to the problem who are closest to the solutions. And that is something else that the progressive movement does. You know, I love these people who run these housing justice or housing rights organizations that have never been homeless in a day in their life, don't know what it means to not be able to pay a bill, to not have a roof over your head. And you will never come up with the solutions. And so that's where
you're pointing to things then. Lived experience. And if you don't have lived experience, some form of neutrality that is supported by accountability.
Correct. I'm not saying when I taught, and I hear from a lot of specifically white progressives who I feel like they hear Charlie Brown want when I'm talking. I didn't say you couldn't be at the table. What I'm saying is that you can't lead the table. And that's what happens in these movements. And you are correct. The accountability is, let's do some performance measurements over the money you've been given over these years, and you have not resolved any of these problems. And let's start giving this money and taking on the ideas of those people who are closest to the problems, who actually are coming up with solutions. And again, I said receipts. Here's a receipt. For years before the pandemic, activists in Ohio in particular said, you know what, we're going to take over the eviction courts. We're just going to go down and chain ourselves and say, nope, you're not going to do this anymore. And housing rights activists, White Hat, said, oh, that's not how we do this. Please don't do that. Let's try some other way. We can figure this out a different way, because they didn't like the resistance of chaining yourselves to the court. But what happened in 2020 during the pandemic? Those activists in Ohio chained themselves to the eviction courts, and it changed the eviction system in the state of Ohio, which has now happened around the country. Black women in Oakland said, we're going to take over these houses that are empty because nobody's living in them, and we need a house to stay in. And what did housing rights activists tell them? White housing rights activists said, don't do that. That's not how we do this. We're going to do it the right way. You're going to get in trouble, blah, blah, blah. But that is revolutionary thinking, is doing something different. That is what bell hooks, Audre Lorde, Barbara Jordan, they all said. And so those Black women took over those houses in Oakland, and who's living in those houses now, right? So this is why we need to see a change in how the work of liberation is done, not in progressive movement. We are talking about liberating an entire society. You have a fascist racist going into the White House. It is only going to be through the terms of resistance and revolutionary thinking that we change what is happening in this country.
So I'm going to go ahead and do this. I want to punctuate that it's a matter of public record, your concern about the president-elect, since he mocked a journalist who had a disability on stage. So it's a matter of public record. But, we're talking about different means of transformation, and you've suggested truth and reparations. Are there some other components that you'd like to describe?
Yeah, sure. And you're right. It's public record that the president-elect did that, but it's also public record that unfortunately the vice presidential candidate's son at the Democratic Party, Democratic National Convention in Chicago, was mocked for being a disabled young man. And that was done, again, by Democrats and Republicans alike. So that's why I say, I don't know if you all remember, in July, his son, Timothy, was out there, cheering and happy. His son is on the spectrum, has a disability, developmental disability, and he was mocked and made fun of by a lot of people who said he shouldn't have been there. Why was he there? Again, that's that ugly laws concept of why is he in public? He should be at home. And so I just want people to understand, it's not just, the MAGA folks, let's be real here. It is a concept that continues, that ghost, that ugly ghost of the ugly laws continues to be a part of our society. So let's remember that. And so different components is what I said, is that we need to move out of the way, those of us who aren't disabled, and let disabled folks lead this work. I also talk about, again, in my book, To Be a Problem, A Black Woman's Survival in the Racist Disability Rights Movement. I discussed that the center of any revolutionary work should also be centered on Black disabled people. That once you remove the barriers of Black and brown and indigenous disabled people, you will remove the barriers of all people. And that has been not only discussed and looked at and has actually agreed upon over and over again in many different social justice conversations. And so that's what's going on there. Also, another component for me, even being an abolitionist, is moving the abolitionist movement, where it's the ending of prisons and jails. It also has to include the ending of any institution that holds anybody in bondage, which are mental health institutions, group homes, nursing homes, actual schools, troubled teen centers that we have, where you are actually there's the LRE, our LRE is that people can live the life they want to live. And so people like, why don't you like group homes? I'm fine with a group home, if that's five disabled people living in a home, as long as the group home isn't run by a faith-based organization that says every Sunday you have to go to church. right? That is not living the life you want to live. Or we have group homes where the mother who runs they usually call it a mother, that's a problem right there. And then that person locks the refrigerator. You can only eat from this time to that time. They can't have people who come over, least restrictive environment. Thank you. That's what LRE says. That, right? That's the least restrictive environment. They can't have guests come over and stay with them. They can't have their family. That cannot happen. So moving the abolitionist community and moving people to understand, if you center Black disabled people in that abolitionist movement, you would understand that there are institutions outside of prisons and jails that keep bodies in bondage. And we can't have that in this society.
Listeners, you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. This is We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, but more importantly, our guest, Dara Baldwin, who's an activist, advocate, scholar, and writer with decades of experience being concerned with disability justice. And Ms. Baldwin, thank you so much for being with us. We've got minutes to go. Allow me to do some housekeeping. And again, I want to thank people as we start out the new year for financially and supporting WPFW with this mission of jazz and justice for everyone in our attempts together to build a better communities, one broadcast at a time. It's exemplified by such programming from 3 to 5, Sophie's Parlor, which is the oldest women's collective on public broadcasting, public radio, bringing you music and culture by women before everyone. At 2 p.m. On the dial is Shewanana with Zen El Amin, addressing concerns of Middle Eastern affairs. At 1 p.m., host Muiza Mutali is on Africa Now. It's a program that focuses on African descended people, not only on the continent, but throughout the diaspora, concerning things of culture, environment, history, politics, and more. And every noon hour during the week, we don't forget the blues. That Wednesday edition coming up next is with Clarence the Bluesman Turner. That's all due to you, the listener, empowering our 50,000 watt broadcast and social media platforms with various shows from 100 different programmers. And I thank you for being with us. There's so many ways to support the station, not only quarterly when we have our fund drives, but throughout the year. I know, again, some of you listen on WPFWFM.org. There's a bright red donate button. Some of you listen through your phone, so you can use Cash App, $WPFWFM. And through texting, if you text WPFWFM 801-801, you will get instructions on how to donate. In each of these cases, specify the show so you know that that individual programmer is aware that you're supporting the station and they appreciate the efforts of the program. And again, I thank you for that. Ms. Baldwin, we barely 2 minutes to go, and you've talked about creating a new world order, imagining a new world where people believe in each other. You're asking us to believe in Black people, brown people, people from all sorts of backgrounds who are multi-marginalized. What would be your final word to us?
Oh, first of all, peace and blessings. And again, thank you for We the People. This show is wonderful. We need to keep doing this and having these conversations. Please go out and get my book. I want to help people read it and understand it. I also want to say my book has created change. CCD, the group I talked about, has created an anti-racist committee. You have to be more than anti-racist. You have to be pro-Black as well. And they have also started, I had a book conversation with them about this book. And that is what I want. I want this book to create change in the way in which we do social justice work. And I hope people find it to be a book of instruction as well as a book of hope for them to do that. I also want to say thank you to my publisher, Beacon Press, who's absolutely wonderful. They've been great with me. And all of the people who wrote quotes about my book, who read my book, V, the formerly known as Eve Ensler, Medea Benjamin, Khalid Baden, people, you know, 6 degrees of separation in the world. There's 2 degrees of separation in this activism work. So I just wanted to say that, say thank you to Zachary Norris and Brittany Barnett. You know, we are activists doing this work, and we are blessed to do this work. And I will continue to fight for hope and change. And I also want to say thank you to all the Black and Brown disabled folks out there who continue every day to get up in the morning and say, I'm going to make a change. And I do believe no matter what, we will make a change. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end to all things. So January 20, 2025 is the beginning, and there will be an end to that 47th administration, and we need to be ready.
Again, thank you, Ms. Baldwin. Dara Baldwin talking about disability justice. Coming up next is the news. My thanks to Mike Bissell, our engineer. And coming up next, 5 minutes before, for being with us this hour, and take good care until we meet again on the radio.
We are slaves to the king, 6 new moons of the year. He pockets our blood and our sweat, leaves us to our tears.
What do Angela Davis, Mehdi Hasan, Ibrahim X. Kendi, V, formerly Eve Ensler, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, Sonia Sanchez, Amy Goodman, Medea Benjamin, Mosab Abu Toha, Congresswoman Cori Bush, Noura Erekat, Congressman Jamal Bowman, Farafina Khan, Linda Sarsour, Isra Shakir, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and WPFW have in common? Well, Busboys and Poets 2025 Peace Ball, Voices of Justice and Liberation, an event featuring live music, speeches, performances, food, and drink. Details, including a complete list of speakers and performers, as well as how you can both support WPFW and join the fun on Saturday, January 18th, 8 p.m. at Arena Stage's Mead Center for American Theater, can be found at WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
We're back! WPFW is excited to announce the return of the Social Justice Calendar, your go-to weekly update on the latest events, actions, and initiatives promoting equity, justice, and change across our community. The calendar's mission is to connect you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Each week, we'll spotlight rallies, workshops, forums, and community actions happening across the region. If you have an event to share, submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of said event in a format that is no longer than a sentence or two on Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, at least 2 weeks in advance of your event date. Space is limited, so submissions are considered in the order that they are received. The Social Justice Calendar is yet another way that WPFW connects, engages, and uplifts our community as we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available from iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice.